You are listening to the Retirement Wisdom Podcast, focusing on the changing nature of retirement today and the non-financial aspects of a successful retirement transition. Join host Joe Casey and learn from leading experts in the field and the stories of people who created interesting second acts as they share practical ideas and tips to create your own. Check out our website at retirementwisdom.com, where you can download our newsletter and other resources to learn more about how coaching can help you. The best way to support this podcast is to head over to Apple Podcasts and post a rating and a comment. It's easy and it's free. Join our conversations and get wiser about your retirement.
Welcome to the Retirement Wisdom Podcast. I'm Joe Casey, and I'll be joined shortly by Dennis Wissman. Last year, we had the pleasure of interviewing Michelle Panner-Silver, author of the book Retirement and Its Discontents. It's based on a research of what happens when people really love what they do and then retire. Today, we have a guest who shares his experience with the flip side. What happens if you really don't love what you do and then it's time to retire? Mark Shakin spent 41 years in the law, and then one day, no more law, just like that. After he retired, Mark wrote a book about the experience. It's titled And Just Like That, Essays on a Life Before, During, and After the Law. Mark is a survivor of a decades-long career in the corporate bankruptcy trenches. He sat for 10 years on its law firm's board of directors and was a member of its strategic planning committee. He holds his BA from Haverford College and received his JD from Washburn University. He's also a graduate of the Colorado Business Committee for the Arts Leadership Arts Program. He holds seats on art boards. He also sits on Metro Denver's Audit and Finance Committee for the Board of Habitat for Humanity and is a member of the Downtown Denver Partnerships Mobility and Housing Councils. He now measures his life by what he gives, and he enjoys that immensely. He's actively engaged as a photographer, including sports photography, and he's now started his next book titled Fresh Start, a Bankruptcy Novel. Mark, thanks so much for joining us today.
Yeah, thanks, Joe and Dennis, and really feel lucky to be on your show. Thanks.
So tell us how you decided to become a lawyer.
So, you know, as a college kid, I never thought I was destined to be an attorney for sure. That was not in my thinking at all. And in that sort of denial continued even as I took the bar, went to law school and then took the bar exam and began my career. You know, I went to law school because I couldn't figure out what to do. And I sort of negotiated with myself that I would go to law school for 3 years. And during those 3 years, I'd figure out what my life path would be. And I guess I needed more than 3 years because I spent the next four decades as a lawyer trying to figure out what my other path or paths might be. And interestingly, that sort of process, which sounds odd, is common amongst lawyers in what I learned in my career. And I wrote a book to try to explain all of that called And Just Like That, Essays on a Life Before, During, and After the Law. And I think that I am correct that lawyers go through this process of why did I become a lawyer? Was this really the thing I should have done? Perhaps more than other professions, because I think I hit a chord or resonated with the readers about that path. And I sure spent an awful lot of time during my career, you know, trying to think of other things to do, maybe dreaming of other things to do, and certainly negotiating with myself as to how much longer I would hang on as an attorney. But I finally found my path out and I took it. And now I'm in the not-for-profit world where I feel like I get to ask every day at the end of the day what I gave. And I enjoy that immensely. That's quite different than what you find in the law firm world, where you tend to be measuring your career by what you get. And I certainly did some of that during my career, but now I get to measure my life by what I'm giving, and that makes me real happy.
I appreciate that. And what was your day-to-day life like as an attorney?
Yes, I mean, I was a commercial bankruptcy lawyer for 38 years, and it's a pretty contentious practice area. There's, you know, oftentimes, or perhaps most times, not enough money to go around to pay everybody back. And so that sort of leads to conflict, to say the least. And I always would sort of come home and say, when did you become so contentious? You weren't that way, you know, growing up. You weren't that way in college. How did this happen? At times, I hated it. At times, I tolerated it, but I never really liked it. There are people that really thrive on that. I was good at it, but I didn't like it. And so I would say that for most of my time as a lawyer in a big firm, as a partner, I was doing something that I was good at, but I didn't particularly like. And if I dwelled on that, focused on that too much, it could kind of make me an unhappy person. And that would make my wife unhappy if I'm unhappy. And the whole thing just sort of mushrooms. So I spent an awful lot of time just trying very hard not to think about how I felt about being a lawyer. So that was a typical day or a week for me.
Now, I'm part of several group discussions where people have talked about what else can we call retirement, because everyone hates that word. And I love your replacement word for retirement, afterlife.
Yeah.
And one of your essays is titled, What I Don't Do and What I Do. And that makes me curious about what's your afterlife like now?
Well, I think it's great. I smile an awful lot, as I point out in the book, which is not necessarily an emotion that you do a lot of as an attorney. I don't feel like I retired from the law. I retired to do something else. So I was sort of looking at some point. I stopped looking to get out of the law and I started looking to get into something else. And that's what kind of led me to describe it as an afterlife. I, like others, don't like the word retire. I'm hoping to be, and so far I am, super busy. I'm just not going to court. I'm not calling witnesses and I don't have partners and I don't have judges that I have to answer to. And that's all good for me.
And after a required 9 months notice, wow, your retirement day finally arrived.
Yeah.
Take us back. What was that day like? And what was the transition like after that initial euphoria?
Yeah. So our firm, and I've learned many firms have a very long retirement notice process. And it's not something that actually every one of the partners follows. A number of partners just say, okay, today I've had enough, and they walk and they don't give more than a day notice. But I gave a 9 months notice, largely because I had planned this all out. I planned what I would do when I ended up not being a lawyer anymore. I planned how much things I would do. I had started to plan on writing my book. And for me, that was very important, rather than stop being a lawyer and then try to figure out what you're going to do. And I've read a lot of books about, you know, folks who have retired that are providing advice. And there are some people who have advocated you should stop being a lawyer and then give no thought whatsoever to what you're going to do. Take sort of 2 months off. And that may work for some. It wouldn't have worked for me at all. And so I had my path pretty well planned out, which was good. I was ready to join the boards. I was ready to join the Finance and Audit Committee for Habitat for Humanity here in Denver, turn my attention to things that I really was passionate about, and give as much time as they would have. It turns out most of these organizations will take as much time as you have to give them. They're really looking for help. The only thing that impacted my plan was something I hadn't considered, which was this period of euphoria when I walked out of the firm for the last time and my old secretary gave me a hug, and then I'm out on the street in Denver walking home and wondering, you know, whether there's some partner police that are going to come running after me and drag me back to the firm. And when that didn't happen, thankfully, all of a sudden I felt euphoric. And that went on for a couple of months. I hadn't really counted on that. And it wasn't an emotion that you tend to feel at all in the practice of law. So nothing I'd ever really dealt with before. And it just kind of gets in the way. You wake up and you're feeling so good, this massive release of endorphins, I guess, for me, that whatever I wanted to do, I just had this mindset, I could do it tomorrow. And that included writing the book. That included a number of things I had planned to do. And so I really needed to get past that period of euphoria, which luckily I did, 6 weeks or so. And then I kind of got onto the business of helping kids, you know, learn art in the inner city, helping people get into homes, I teach photography to veterans who have PTSD. And all of those things are, for me, just fill my day and make me pretty darn happy.
Well, Mark, you mentioned the importance of the planning that you did. And if you think back to before, when you had, when you were working and you were getting through this up to this point where you're going to make the transition, first of all, I was wondering, how long did it take you to actually, from the time you said, I'm going to go, to the day you actually said, I'm going? And what kind of help besides the self-reflection? Did you get any other outside help along the way?
Yeah, I mean, great question. I've looked back on how this happened, how I escaped. And wondered, you know, how long were you really legitimately thinking about it? And I keep getting stuck on the notion that I've been thinking about this for 3 years in law school and 38 years in practice, for a total of 41 years. Wow. And for 40 of those years, I didn't have any help. And I was floundering. And I started reading some books, you know, sort of self-help how-to books about career change or career pivot. There's different words in the industry that I've learned people use. And I like the idea of career change and pivot rather than, you know, retire from being a lawyer and just sort of sit at home. No interest in that. And a lot of the books, though, I didn't find very helpful. They were good, but they weren't really for me. And then I read a book by the former, I think he was the treasurer of Bank of America for a number of years. And he had started a company to help executives exit into something else. And I'd not ever really heard of that before. And so I actually ended up calling him at his house in North Carolina and telling him I read his book, and it was the first one I had read that I found applicable to me. But nowhere in the book did he talk about helping lawyers transition. And had he ever done a lawyer before, I think is the question I posed to him. And he hadn't, and he wondered why lawyers were different. And I said, I think they are. I think that they get to the law in a different way than somebody with an MBA gets into the business world, for example. And they might pose a challenge to help them find something else they can do, because you spend an awful lot of time in the law thinking that there's nothing else you can do. That's how you got into the law for the first time. And finding it hard to identify something you're passionate about, you know, when the law is sort of all-encompassing. And there's this phrase, the law is a jealous mistress, that one of the Supreme Court justices coined back at the turn of into the 20th century. And it's so true. You end up fighting this thing, the practice of law, for a long time to find balance. And it's very hard to find balance. And to be sure, business people have constraints on their time, as lawyers do, but they don't tend to have judges and other things that make the constraints pretty seriously significant. So I go through this whole speech and I tell him all this as if I'm trying to get him to not want to take me on as a client. And he agrees to do it. And he assigned me a retired executive, I think from Allstate, who just turned out to be a wonderful fit, and really spent a couple of months, 2-3 months, getting to know me, talking me through this, not appearing to lead me down a particular path, and helping me gather my own thoughts after all this time to figure out what I would continue to do rather than just sit at home with a remote control in front of the TV. And it was a great process. I mean, I don't give out a lot of advice about this since I'm not an expert and it's so personal, but the one thing I do tell people over and over again is, if this is the point of your career that you find yourself in, find somebody to help you figure out what the next stage of your life will be like. Don't do it yourself.
So Mark, you wrote in your book about realizing that you were always more of a heart guy than a head guy. What have you learned about yourself and your life after the law?
Yeah. So that comes from Marc Chagall, the famous artist, who said that if he creates from the heart, everything works. And if he creates from the head, nothing works. And I heard that early on in my life. And unfortunately, the heart kind of life doesn't pay the bills very well, or it wouldn't have for me. So you sort of turn to the head. And for me, that led to the practice of law. But in the afterlife, I can do whatever I want. I can be a head person or a heart person. And right now, the heart really gives me a fulfilling life, to be truthful. One of the organizations that I'm involved in, you know, sends artists into inner city schools here in Colorado to teach the kids art at a young age and then follow them through till they graduate from high school. Art being one of the things that gets cut pretty quickly when a school system is economically stressed, like the schools are out here right now in Denver. And what is interesting about teaching kids art at a very young age is the rate of graduation from high school goes way up, and the rate of going on to college, it goes way up. And I'm all about that. I was one of those kids, you know, in the inner city schools without an art program, and got introduced to photography that way. And it was extremely meaningful to me, and it kind of kept me out of trouble, which I was in a little bit of before I got introduced to photography. And for me, that was a very important part of my upbringing. And I firmly believe it's important to not forget art when you're dealing with young kids. And the same I would say about housing. You know, my family moved constantly, as I talk about in the book, and that tends to have a negative effect. So if you're not in a home that the family owns, you know, you tend to move every year when the lease is up. And that changes the school system. It changes the kids' sphere of influence every year, which is terrible. In Habitat, we build homes one at a time, and we put people into the homes, and the family then owns the home and stays together. I think most people know the Habitat story. But the statistics of what happens when you put a family into a home is really similar to the art statistic. The young kids finish high school. They go off to college just by having a stable place to live. I can get on my bully pulpit and talk about those kinds of things constantly, but as a lawyer, I didn't have enough time to do anything about it. Now I do.
And it sounds like it really makes a big difference. Appreciate what you're doing there.
I think it's a little difference, but little differences by a lot of people count.
No doubt.
Yeah.
Absolutely. So these days you're in a very creative space as a photographer. And sometimes when we think back on our early years in school, every once in a while we're told that we're not very creative. And there was a great story in your book about how a teacher critiqued something you created, and it ended up revealing something to you that you didn't know.
Yeah, that was my second grade teacher, and the class was required to draw her. So she sat in front of the class, and we were supposed to draw her, the first portrait that any of us probably ever drew. And she turns out she was wearing a pink dress, and everybody in the class drew a pink dress, and I drew a blue dress. And so she thought I was being a smart aleck. So she sent me off to the principal's office, who sent me off to the nurse's office. And luckily that was a good thing, because the nurse gave me a colorblind test, and it turned out I was somewhat significantly colorblind. And so luckily the nurse caught that. And the consequence of learning that I was colorblind, though, is that I completely gave up anything like art. I was very self-conscious. Hated it when people learned I was colorblind as a kid and then began to say, okay, what color is this? What color is that? And they'd show you an orange or a shirt. And, you know, you were on the spot to either guess correctly or remember that oranges are orange, even if it doesn't look orange to you. And so I then got to high school, and the school that I was going to, as rough as it was, it had an art requirement. And I blew that off completely, because there was no way I was going to sit in an art class and go through this. And that got me to my second principal's visit about art. And it turned out that there was an organization like the one I'm now on the board here in Denver, Think 360 Arts for Learning. There was an organization like that in New Haven, Connecticut, and they were installing a photography teacher for the school to teach black and white photography to inner city kids. And so my whole story about being colorblind was met with, well, that won't be a problem because there's no color in this class. And that was my first intro to photography, and the first time I got back into being more creative and artistic. And it just, I loved it, and just completely has stuck since 15. So basically 40 years of being a photographer.
Wow. Thanks for sharing those stories. Appreciate it. So as you know, attorneys are very highly trained. And I'm wondering, how can lawyers use their skills in other ways outside the law in their afterlife?
Yeah, and another great question. It sort of starts with something that I said a little while ago, that you spend an awful long period of your law career thinking there's nothing else that you can do, when in fact, the things that you have learned as a lawyer or learned how to do as a lawyer are very useful in the non-law world in the afterlife. So I don't want to be a lawyer, so when I sit on the boards, I want to make sure they understand I'm not the board's lawyer anymore. I don't want to practice law or give out legal advice. But, you know, lawyers are trained to be problem solvers and trained to be very analytical. They're not the only profession that does that, but for lawyers, you're very analytical. Analytical is really helpful when an organization is struggling. So, for example, during COVID-19, all three of my organizations are pretty stressed financially, like so many for-profit organizations as well. The revenue stream is dripping as opposed to running or dried up completely. And how do you break that problem down into small chunks and try to put in place new policies and programs to keep the organization alive, because they are still doing good work? How do you pivot from being an in-person art organization where teachers are going into the schools to being an online art organization teaching six-year-olds art through YouTube videos all of a sudden that you're pivoting to make. And I think the organizational skills, and I think that the being very methodical part of being a lawyer are quite helpful. But the part that isn't helpful that you really need to put someplace far away is the contentious part. It's not useful to be an arguer anymore. And it's really important to manage that and turn that off because the rest of the world doesn't really want to hear that.
Yeah. Except if you're in politics.
Yeah, which I'm wonderfully happy that I'm not. Yes.
So, Mark, one last question. Based on your experiences, what advice would you offer someone listening, whether they're a lawyer or a non-lawyer, about how to create a life after their primary career?
Well, the first thing is I would focus more on the kinds of things that a person is passionate about, that they enjoy doing, and what is it about those things that can translate into other things that you could do after you cease doing whatever your career has been. And that's not a sit down and have a glass of wine one night and figure it out. That's a process that takes a fair amount of thought. So if you identified that you like to do photography for me, but I'm not going to be a full-time professional photographer in my afterlife. So how can that be translated into something that one can do afterward? And it's an awful big world with a lot of things that people do and a lot of organizations that will, take as much help as you can give them. But in the process of trying to think through all of that, it was what I learned in my life as a lawyer was that process was completely over my head. It was not something that I could pull off all by myself. And once I found someone who could help, who had been through this with other folks, so they actually had a skill set in how this works, I made a lot of progress at that point in eliminating things that really weren't going to work for me, and then identifying things that would. And that plus, no one should think that the only thing they can do until the day they die is the thing they're doing. That's not my view of how humans are constructed.
Well, Mark, you've learned it clearly through this journey, and you've adapted very, very nicely to following your heart, which is outstanding. I think it's just a wonderful story. The challenges along the way, you learning photography and your whole background in photography, how you developed it. Did you find this smooth, or did you find it ups and downs, or did you kind of have a straight path or a kind of wiggly path to itself?
Yeah, I don't think there's much about life that's linear, even if it's somebody that's always known what they wanted to do and then does it. There's nothing about life that's linear, which makes it kind of interesting. The ups and the downs can be scary, but that's what living on planet Earth is. So nothing that I have ever done has been linear, including in the afterlife. I've learned a lot of things, post my law career that I didn't know about myself that makes even what I'm doing now not particularly linear, but I'm used to that at this point. And so it doesn't scare me as much as it might have when I was, 25 or 30.
Mark, thanks so much for sharing your insights. I know it's going to be very helpful to a lot of people, and appreciate learning what you're doing these days and how you got there.
Oh, thanks very much. I appreciate the opportunity to be on the show. And if you don't mind me plugging the book just one more time, if your audience liked this conversation, they would make an author happy by finding a way to read my book.
And we'll include a link to your website and the book in the show notes, as we always do.
Okay, thanks so much.
Thanks. Sure.
Thank you, Mark.
Thanks.
So Dennis, what were your takeaways from our conversation?
Yeah, thanks, Joe. It was exciting to hear of Mark's adventure and his journey to this transition to the next part of his life. I'm so happy to hear about how he followed his heart. Something he clearly was at this for a period of time, and it wound up to be a real successful thing for him. In following his heart, the first lesson that many people could take away is about the importance of purpose. Mark said that he used to measure himself by what he was getting, but now he measures himself more by what he's giving or what he gave. And it's really important. I've read this. We've had all the other guests on the show, Joe. We talk about this, and that it's really the giving the gift of ourselves to others is where we can really find true meaning in our life. So that was one of the first key things that I took away from this. The second thing was he spent time talking about the importance of planning. He took time to get this right for himself. And he knew when he was ready, and he was ready to go and flick the switch and move on to the next thing. He had aligned the things that he was going to do next for this part of his life. He emphasized how important planning was. So we see this again. It's important to plan on the financial side, but it's also very important to plan how you're going to invest your time and how that's going to align with who you are and what your identity is going to be in this next part of your life. Kind of like the way Mark did. Again, following his heart led him to that. And the last point that I had was the skills and how his skills as an attorney helped him specifically on the board work that he was doing, the nonprofits. This is important because sometimes we don't realize that as we think about what we want to do next. So his problem-solving skills as an attorney, his organization skills, his analytical skills were all very important things that he could take with him and really benefit both the organization and a benefit for himself because he gets to use the things that he enjoyed using the most. He did also mention that, you know, it's important to leave some things at the door. Like he said, he was contentious for some part of his career. And you certainly don't want to do that when you're entering a new an organization, especially an organization like a nonprofit or like a board, where you really want to provide some help to people. So again, a good reminder to us is the skills we acquired, they're not baggage. They're assets. They're benefits to us. And we can take them and go forward. So Joe, what about yourself?
So a few things. Picking up on the transferability point, I think that's a key one. No matter what someone wants to do after they retire, if they're retiring but not done yet, as I like to say, is to really take inventory of what are those core skills you have and how can they be deployed in a different way, sometimes in some creative ways. And take some time to think about that. Second thing is he talked about the period where he left and walked out after a 9-month notice, and it was euphoria. But that lasted for quite a while, but not forever. So to expect that honeymoon period to end, and he had felt the itch to begin to get into thinking about doing something different. And I like this comment, which echoed one of our last podcast guests, Bruce Feiler's book, Life is in the Transitions. Not much of life is linear. And to really expect that going in and to give yourself the space to do it. And then finally, his comments about when you think about doing something different after a primary career, really keep in mind that it's a big world and that there are lots of opportunities. They may take some time to explore, may take a different perspective to discover them. And it's always something that's best done with a partner. So think about having some assistance with someone who specializes in the field. We appreciate him taking the time. Great story and a lot of great insights. And we thank you for listening to the Retirement Wisdom Podcast.
Thank you for joining us today on the Retirement Wisdom Podcast. You can listen to all episodes of our podcast by subscribing to them on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, and Stitcher, or on our website at retirementwisdom.com.